Thank you so much for seeing me, Mr. Ding Dong. My whole life, all I ever wanted to do was perform with the Ding Dong, Killabrew, and Baba Ganoush Brothers Circus.
Just don't waste my time, kid. The Ding Dong, Killabrew, and Baba Ganoush Brothers Circus has an opening to fill on account of the departure of Ezra the Human Fly.
Why did he leave?
One day in Rochester, his suction cups didn't suck. The memorial service was beautiful. Alphonse the Human Regurgitator ate 3,000 Skittles and puked up a rainbow. What's your act, kid?
They call me Pansy the Fireproof Woman. First, I hold boiling oil in my cupped hands. My assistant drops an egg in, and the audience sees it cook. And then I put molten lead in my mouth and pull out coins. For my finale, I heat a shovel until it's red hot, and then I lick it.
Amazing. How do you do it?
How do I do what?
The egg, the lead, the shovel, dummy.
Don't you have to figure that out? Isn't that how the circus works?
That is not how the Ding Dong, Killabrew, and Baba Ganoush Brothers Circus works, you pinhead. I never made it past third grade. No Ding Dong ever has. You think I taught the Dankowski brothers how to juggle? You think I taught the Great Garbanzo how to be a human arrow? You know what your problem is, kid?
What, Mr. Ding Dong?
You live here. If you lived in Bulgaria, you'd know how to swing on a rope across a wall of fire or be shot out of a catapult or jump on the back of a galloping horse. Because, kid, most circus acts are basically about how to get out of some terrible country where 80 people have to share one potato.
I am so ashamed that I didn't understand.
Whatever, don't beat yourself up. I need you to leave, but help yourself to a clown on your way out. Any clown, it doesn't matter.
Clowns are free?
These ones are. I hate all of them.
I need to know more about the circus. Here's a show about the greatest show on earth. And now, the man with three buttocks, Colin McEnroe.
That's a personal thing. Well, there was some joking in that, although some of it was serious. There actually was an act, very much like the one described there, a woman, a fireproof woman. I think she didn't do the circus so much. I think she mainly did vaudeville and other kinds of kind of daredevil type of performances. And that's maybe even a distinction worth making today as we talk about the circus. I've always been fascinated by the circus, and I've interviewed a lot of circus performers over the years. You might have heard me say before the news, one of the most interesting conversations I ever had in my life was with a guy named Dave Hoover, who was a big cat trainer for Cole Brothers Circus. I also remember interviewing at one point, in fact, some Bulgarian women, beautiful Bulgarian women who had a pigeon and poodle act. I think it turned out that their husbands and brothers and stuff had one of those acts where you jump onto the back of galloping stallions. And they had a pigeon and poodle act. The pigeons were kind of, they looked like they'd been dipped in Easter egg dye or something. And then the poodles would stand up on their hind legs and then stick their front arms out, and the pigeons would balance on their arms. And there were other stuff like that. And I remember interviewing them. They were the loveliest, nicest people, but quite a bit of translation had to go on. I think the only one of them spoke English. And I asked them, I said, what's the most difficult part about this act? And there was some conferring done in Bulgarian. And then the one who spoke English said, the hardest part is to train the poodles not to eat the pigeons, which is kind of what I assumed would be the hardest part of the act. But anyway, circuses are amazing. You know, they really are. We may have a somewhat unsettled relationship with certain aspects of them, but they do bring together a kind of entertainment that makes people gasp. You know, you bring a kid to the circus or anything like the circus, a live performance where the outcomes can't be controlled, where there seems to be genuine danger in the air at times, you know, when everything isn't digitized and rewindable and fixable in post-production. Things are just unfolding. And people gasp the way they don't gasp at other things. So we're going to talk today about the circus, about our whole historic relationship with the circus. It started to get really real when it turned out we had a member of the Walenda family on there. I don't think there's a performing member of the circus with a more famous name than Walenda. We have with us today Rick Walenda, record-holding high-wire walker, a member of the world-famous flying Walenda family. We also have, at least we hope we have, Linda Simon, professor emeritus at Skidmore College and the author of The Greatest Show on Earth, A History of the Circus. As we go along, we're going to talk to Bruce Feiler. He is a columnist for the Sunday New York Times and author of Under the Big Top, A Season with the Circus. He ran off to be a clown. A little bit later, we'll talk to Stephen Payne, the vice president of Feld Entertainment, the parent company of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus. But Rick Walenda, I kind of want to begin with you. I mean, it really, I can't even believe I'm talking to a Walenda right now. But for people who don't know the story of your family, explain how long the Walendas have actually been circus performers.
We can document all the way back to the early 1800s through records that my Aunt Jenny had to keep during the war in Germany. to prove that she was not of Jewish heritage. And so we suspect that it probably goes on further than that, but she had to document only four generations back. And they were all entertainers and in the circus, except for one guy. We don't know what was wrong with him. He was an umbrella maker.
So, and your grandfather, I think it was, had a saying, life is on the wire, everything else is just waiting.
Right. And I can relate to that tremendously because it was, I'm sitting here at home right now. I can't wait for the next time I'm going to be able to do a show. I love doing the shows.
Now, you love doing the shows. But the shows are dangerous. We'll talk as we go on about how dangerous they are. They're dangerous to you. You've fallen off the wire how many times? At least twice, right?
Boy, you do good research.
Yeah.
Yes.
And one time you broke your back.
Yeah, I have a L1 has a compression fracture, yeah.
And so, you know, if I don't know. I'm the Selective Service classifies me as a coward in time of war. I wouldn't have to even fall off the wire once before I decided I wasn't going to do it anymore. So, I mean, can you explain, like why you go back up after you've had that experience?
Yeah, by the way, during the Vietnam War, that excuse didn't work. They sent you anyway.
Okay.
I go back up on the wire because I love doing it, and I realized that it was a mistake that I made.
Mm-hmm.
And so you correct the mistake. When somebody dies in an automobile accident, you drive to the funeral.
Right.
Right? You're not afraid to drive. You just, maybe you're a little more careful about it.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the history of the Willendes. Part of the history I know begins in the 1940s when, in fact, your family perfected a trick. I think it was called Seven on a Wire. Is that what it was called?
The seven-person pyramid.
Yeah.
The seven on a wire sounds more like a candy or something.
I guess that's true. And so this is what it sounds like. You're on a high wire. There's no net, and there's a pyramid of people, totaling seven people, right?
Right.
And I read somewhere that Ringling Brothers actually rejected that. They didn't want it?
Yeah, they were actually working on the design and the engineering and the dynamics of presenting the seven-person pyramid on the wire in the 30s already. And they had two troops of high wire performers on the Ringling Show. The Willendes did. One was my grandfather and the other one was his brother's act. And in the wintertime, they would all get together and they would practice this thing, the seven. And when they finally, in 1946, they presented it to Ringling, and Ringling said, "Nah, we don't want it. Too expensive," or whatever the reason was. I don't know.
And so did they just start their own traveling company as a result of that?
Yeah, they actually went and did their own circus and presented the seven-person pyramid under the banner of the Willendes Circus.
So I want to add Linda Simon to the conversation. We've been having some technological problems with this, but we think we've reached her by phone now. Linda Simon, professor emeritus at Skidmore College and author of The Greatest Show on Earth, A History of the Circus. Linda Simon, you know, I was asking Rick Willenda about danger. Danger has kind of always been part of this, right? That I don't know if it always has, but there's something kind of inherently true about the circus, that it is a kind of performance we watch at least partly because it at least looks dangerous to us and maybe is dangerous to the people doing it. How universal and historical is that?
You're absolutely right. It's universal and historical, and really the reason why people gather together to watch performers. It's that gasp that you mentioned when you were introducing the circus. There's this sense of, first of all, identifying with the performers and then seeing them in danger and hoping that they're not going to fall, and yet, you know, that would be pretty exciting if they did. So, yes, danger is definitely an allure for circus goers.
And how far back can we look and see something that kind of resembles a circus? I take it it's well before the BC, I mean, it's well before the modern era. You can go back, what, 1,000 years BCE?
Well, you can go back to performer.
Oop, we might have just lost her. Linda, you still there?
Sam.
Okay. Oh, she's on ISDN. This is even better. Okay, great, Linda. We can hear you even better now. So, yeah, so take us way back in time and tell us what we see. We see something that looks like a circus. It's not called a circus. It's not quite the same thing, right?
Right. Well, we see people performing in ways that human beings were not supposed to perform. So contortionists were really big attractions, people who were walking on high wires or slack wires, acrobats, you know, they were all very attractive, and they came to fairs and they passed the hat around and they were itinerant performers. But I would say that the sort of modern circus that we know really started in the 18th century with horse shows. So they were equestrian performers, and they performed around a ring. And when they, when the horses trotted around the ring, the performers could do acrobatics on the horses, and that was pretty amazing. And in intervals, they had these little pigeon and poodle acts, you know, that geese and dogs and stuff like that, clowns eventually. That became more and more and more sophisticated, and that's really the sort of model of the modern circus that we know.
You know, my possibly romanticized and distorted vision of this is that, and I've always thought about this, that, you know, if you go back to that time, to the 18th century, the average person didn't have a lot of mobility. You know, you lived in your village. It was, you know, still a pretty agrarian world in Europe. There were no cars. There was no television, obviously. There weren't a lot of things. So I kind of always assumed that when the circus came somewhere near you, it was like the world coming somewhere near you. It was people from countries that you would never stand any chance of visiting. It was things that just didn't in any way, that completely violated everything thing about your normal daily experience, that suddenly a world in a, you know, maybe in a relatively small town somewhere in Europe was in contact with everything else there was, or so it must have seemed.
Yes, absolutely. And not only in Europe, of course, in Europe in the 18th, 19th century, and circus performers played upon that. So even if they were local and not exotic, they dressed up and put on makeup and gave themselves exotic names so that viewers would think, wow, you know, the whole world is coming here. But when circuses came to the United States, and this was in the, you know, sort of 18th, 19th century, again, if you were living in a small town and didn't have contact with people from other places or animals from other places, it became amazing to go to the circus. Just amazing, a transporting, magical experience.
And Rick Willenda, I have to assume that for people, maybe in a different way, people have so many other sources of stimulation these days. People have so many things that they can watch. They can move around the world much more easily than they could in the 1700s. But still, I would assume when you guys come to town, there's something anyway happening in town that doesn't happen the rest of the year.
Yeah, it's true. They don't get to see these kinds of things daily walking down the street. You can see it on YouTube anytime you want to, but that's a little screen that you're looking at, a flat screen. But, you know, being able to see the thing live right in front of you, that's a totally different ballgame. We are live entertainment, and that can't be beaten by YouTube.
Yeah, and I have to say that when my son was young, I just started making sure we went to stuff like this. We went to the circus. We went to a lot of the new vaudeville stuff. So even when you're seeing, say, like the Flying Karamazov brothers who are jugglers, you know, the fact is you're watching it live. The tricks may not work. The clubs fall on the ground. They make jokes. They pick it back up again. And there's just a sense of tension that gets ratcheted up. And it gets ratcheted up even more at the circus. We're going to play a little clip of your grandfather, Carl Willenda, talking a little bit about that tension.
Carl Willenda is perhaps the most nerveless man in the world. Are you ever afraid?
No, I think we only think about we want to make the people happy. Mm-hmm. We want to be good. But afraid, not tense. What you call afraid, I never would be afraid. I never would go up there if I was afraid. But tense, you fear, you have sometimes that feeling, you know, what can happen.
So, Rick Willenda, I mean, ultimately, your grandfather did fall and lost his life doing this. On the other hand, there's just this idea with your family that you guys, I mean, working without a net is kind of a cliche for a lot of people. It's not a cliche for you. It's exactly the way you do things. Why do you do things that way?
Well, because if you trust in a safety device, two things are going to happen. One, you're going to have a feeling of false security because, and that's number two, the device could fail or not do what it's supposed to do. My grandfather's brother fell into a net in 1936. He bounced out and landed on the concrete and was killed. And, you know, you're putting your trust in a device rather than in your skill. You know, you practice and you know what you can do, and you don't exceed that limit. You stay within that limit when you are actually performing then. And then that's the safest. The best safety device is practice.
Do we, the audience, focus too much on this other aspect of it? I mean, you know, this has happened a few times. You just mentioned another one of them. This is, you know, part of your act. Do you prefer if people just think about all the times that it does work, which is like 99.9% of the time, you guys just do these amazing things and nothing bad happens?
We don't go up there presuming something bad is going to happen. And we always understand that there are people out there who are bloodthirsty and want to see something bad happen. But I would say 99.9% of the people that watch us don't want anything to happen. But we like to create that tension in them so that they can respect what we're doing. And like my grandfather said, we want to make them happy.
Linda, I want to talk a little bit about sort of the Americanization of the circus. And I'm assuming, I mean, the names that we've said a few times already today are the important names, the names of P.T. Barnum and James Anthony Bailey. Is that kind of when the circus becomes the American version of itself?
Well, that's when the three-ring circus became the version of itself. But I just wanted to add very briefly something to what Rick said.
Sure.
It's not only that you're watching a live performer, but you're watching a live performer together with lots of other people. And there's that energy from the audience that I think the performers feed on, and that just adds to the ambiance of what's happening. And I don't think you get that when you're watching something on YouTube. You can see the skill and admire it, but you don't have that feeling of just watching a spectacle together.
I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely. Yeah, continue. Go ahead.
To the question about the Barnum and Bailey and the Ringlings, in the middle of the 19th century, Barnum wanted the circus to be bigger and bigger and bigger. And instead of enlarging the ring, which would put the audience farther from the performers, he added first one ring, so there were two-ring circus, and then three-ring circus. And wherever you were, you would be seeing something amazing, you know, to watch. Now, some in the audience didn't like that. They wanted just to focus on one thing. But it became, you know, the way to do it. There were huge trains that would take them from city to city. There were thousands and thousands of acts and animals and horses and performers and a big parade, you know, coming into the town. But before that, there were more circuses than you can really count. Mm. And the idea that there was circus day when one circus came to town and then nothing would happen for the rest of the year, that's not true. There were loads of circuses that would come through the towns. And, of course, not all of them survived. Because I'm sure the Feld guest that you have on will say, circus is a business, and it's a dicey business just like any other entertainment. So, you know, not all of them survived. And Barnum and Bailey, because Bailey was the better businessman, were quite successful.
Absolutely. You know, the other aspect of this, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in our second segment, but, you know, this always seems to be such a family thing. Rick, this is just, as you said, I mean, there's one person who decided to make umbrellas, but other than that, and people start early. How young was your mom when she first started wire walking? When did she first walk across the tightrope?
Her first professional appearance, she was 4 years old. It was in 1940. She had been walking the wire already before that. But the first professional appearance was on a Castle Films feat. It was called Little Carla, High Wire Layoff featuring Little Carla, something like that. And we have a copy of it. I think it's even on YouTube. And she's been performing ever since. She's 80 years old. She's got 76 consecutive years of being a daredevil on the high wire and sway pole now. And she's 80 years old still doing it.
Okay, I can't wrap my mind around that. She's 80 years old, and she's still walking out on the wire. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, she'll be appearing in Kokomo, Indiana this weekend, if anybody wants to go see her.
So, Linda, I want to explore, in terms of that, I think another sense of the circus, and it goes back, you know, certainly to the 1700s, but I think it's still there now, is this notion that you're sort of seeing people who are different, right? The people in the circus, they don't work at 9-to-5 jobs, they don't have a water cooler, they don't have a copy machine, that there's something exotic about them. And some of the early thinking even about them was they must be, what, in league with the devil somehow, that there must be part of some actual supernatural alliance. Maybe you can say something about that.
Well, yeah, early on, you know, medieval performers, pre-18th century performers, they seemed to be doing something so amazing, nobody could figure it out. So, of course, if anybody is going to get together and have a good time, there are going to be people to condemn it. We don't, you know, that's just a given. And so there were church condemnation. There were educators that didn't want children to go to the circus. There were parents that thought, you know, this was going to corrupt their children. And the idea that there was something supernatural or unnatural about circus performers fed into that condemnation.
And I would assume that, you know, most of that's gone away, Rick, but there must be still an awful lot of superstition, and maybe from people who are not circus people, projection still onto circus performers, that there's something superstitious or weird going on up there.
We have superstitions in the circus. Most of them I don't adhere to anymore. As a kid, maybe I did. You know, put your shoes on the table. It's bad luck to put your shoes on the table. Whistling in the dressing room is bad luck. A bird in the big top is bad luck. But there's always something behind that. The reason why a bird in the big top could land on an aerialist's head and distract him and make him fall. Whistling in the dressing room could make somebody miss their cue and miss their act. Then shoes on the table. Shoes are supposed to be on the floor. And if you're looking for your shoes, you got to go do your act. They're on the table. Well, then you blew your act then.
Were there people, I mean, the Willendas had some famous falls. Were there people who then started to think that maybe you guys did have a curse or that some kind of really bad luck had attached to you?
Not within the family. Other people may have thought that. I don't recall ever hearing anything like that. But within the family, we really didn't think that there was anything cursed about us. We just had to explain these things and then avoid the whatever the pitfall was in the future.
Now, you guys have gone from being the Willenda troupe to the Great Willendas to the Flying Willendas. And now, as I understand it, there's sort of two different family units of Willendas. Tell us about that.
There's actually five of us that are doing this. My cousin Tino, his sister Delilah with her son Nick, who you've heard of, and myself, my troupe, and my sister and her daughter have a troupe, and then my mother with her husband is out there touring. So there's actually five units of us out there doing this.
And are you guys, is your troupe, you guys are the Great Willendas, and there's another group that's the Flying Willendas?
No, I had to change my name to the world-famous Willendas because of conflict within the family. I don't want to go into that, but I used to call the act the Great Willendas. My grandparents, Carl and Helen, passed the act on to me as the Great Willendas. My sister and I performed under that banner for decades. And then there was a little bit of a problem about 15 years ago, and so I changed the name to the world-famous Willendas.
So tell me again, when's the next time that you personally are up on a wire? How long away are we from that?
Well, we were supposed to be going to the Mississippi State Fair here in about 2 weeks, but something happened, so that's not going to happen. So the next time I'm going to be on the wire will be December 16th in St. Pete, Florida.
I can almost hear in your voice that really isn't soon enough for you, right?
No, I'm very irritated about the Mississippi State Fair because I really wanted to go there.
All right, so you can take the guy out of the circus. You can't take the circus out of the guy. It's always going to be there. Let's take a little break. We'll be back with more of Linda Simon and Rick Willenda. We're going to add Bruce Feiler to the conversation as well. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. All right, we're back. We're talking about the circus, and we're lucky enough to be doing that with Rick Walenda, a record-holding high-wire walker and a member of the world-famous Walenda family. Bruce Feiler is joining us now, a columnist for the Sunday New York Times and the author of Under the Big Top, A Season with the Circus. Also with us, Linda Simon, a professor emeritus at Skidmore College and the author of The Greatest Show on Earth, A History of the Circus. We're going to talk a little bit about joining the circus. You know, Rick didn't have that much choice. If he hadn't joined the circus, he'd have to make umbrellas. He wouldn't have understood anything that was being talked about at Thanksgiving dinners. But for most people, Linda, they do. They join the circus. Well, I don't know about most people. A lot of people join the circus. It's another cliche that's not a cliche, right? People have – can you say a little bit more about how it is that people and from where it is that people might run off and join the circus?
Well, this was really the reason I wanted to write this book, because there is this cultural myth of running away to join the circus. It's like our version of joining the French Foreign Legion. You know, you can reinvent yourself. And people, one of the things I discovered that was so interesting is that people really had different reasons for joining, depending on what they did in the circus. It's like if you think of an orchestra, that the flute player is not going to be the same kind of person as the drum player. So what I found was that people who joined to become clowns had a different motivation from people who were going to be gymnasts or contortionists or sword swallowers or shoot themselves out of a cannon. You know, they had different sense of identity, a different need to perform for other people, and different talents. And they did join. You know, circus is really hard work. And they did join in a kind of to escape what you were saying, you know, a job with a Xerox machine and 9 to 5. They wanted adventure. They wanted the glamour, the glitter, the spangles. And they found a kind of cohesive community that sustained them, and they were very happy in that community and worked hard.
I think people are fascinated by that cohesive community. So we're going to talk to Bruce and Rick some more about that. But Bruce, let's just get you started in this conversation. You did find your way into the circus as a clown. Tell us how that happened.
First of all, I love being with you, Colin. You're really, and I trust your listeners appreciate how great you are at what you do. So I'm always happy to be with you. And my story actually has a sort of Connecticut connection, as it happens. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, and I learned to juggle when I was 12, and it became a sort of passion and a mini obsession of mine. And I used to joke that I put myself through high school by doing birthday parties, so I did mime and juggling. And so it was just one of those things. That's where you could find me on a Saturday afternoon in the backyard juggling. And I considered actually becoming a clown for a year between high school and college, and then didn't do that. I went to Yale and ran the children's theater at Yale for a number of years, and then went off, as you know from other conversations we have, and sort of started traveling the world. I lived in Japan and wrote a book about that. I lived in Britain and wrote a book looking for class about that. And I wanted to come back and sort of rediscover America. So I went back to this passion of mine, and I set out to join a circus. It was in part to have the experience and fulfill this kind of boyhood itch, and in part to write a book. And I think a lot of my experience, and I did, I spent a year, just to sort of put the facts on the table, I spent a year with the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus. Bought a Winnebago, traveled around the country, 16 states, 599 shows. And as you just were hearing, it's incredibly hard work. You're talking 2 shows a day, 3 shows on Saturday, every day from March to December without a day off. And every other day you take down the big top, drive 50, 100, 150 miles sometimes, put the tent back up, and do 2 shows that afternoon. And when you step into a cage with tigers or you walk on the highway, you can't have a bad day, right? You hang by your hair, you can't have a bad hair day. So the degree of work and professionalism is really astonishing and deeply impressive, I would say.
Did you find, Linda talked about this notion of a cohesive community, a group of people who come to understand each other in a very profound way that would be hard to replicate anywhere else. Is that what you found?
Yes and no. I would say that on the one hand, within the circus community, there is a very clear and long-established, decades, maybe centuries-old hierarchy within the community, okay? So at the top, I mean, so the skill performers are at one level. The animals would be beneath them. The people who, where a lot of the money is made, and the people who sell the merchandise, right? And even within the people that sell the merchandise, the people who sell the drinks are higher than the people who sell the popcorn because the drinks make more money. The bottom would be the people who put up and take down the tent, the laborers. The highest performer in many ways would be a bareback rider, because that is combining an animal act and a skill act. So somebody who can do a somersault from one horse and land on the next is combining many of the things. So within the community, there is this incredibly intense hierarchy that's very pronounced. But because, as you've been talking about, because the circus goes from place to place, and then, let's be honest, usually sets up on the edge of town, you know, in places where the land is cheaper and maybe not the best neighborhood. And because circus people tend to be sort of looked down on by sort of townies, if you will, in this sort of us versus them, there's incredible cohesion. Okay, mm-hmm. So this feeling of incredible intimacy and protection and safety. And in so many ways, I never felt safer than when I was in the community. And I could be next door, sleeping next door to somebody who may have just come out of prison and is doing day laboring, putting the tent up. And on the other side would be, as you've heard from the Willendas, you know, 15 generations of circus families going back royalty to Europe. There is cohesion, especially outside the other, but inside the community, there's a clear hierarchy, and you're not supposed to talk to that person, and you're not supposed to do this, and you're not supposed to go there.
Rick, you've had a lot of years with this, sometimes with the circus, sometimes just as your own freestanding act. So is it all true? Do circus performers hang around with circus performers? I mean, even if you're not on the road and you're having a barbecue or something like that, who do you have a few beers with?
Yeah, the camaraderie that he talked about is there, and there are those divisions within. But my grandfather wouldn't really let us look down on the working men. He would have the working men over to the barbecues, and that's still true in a lot of the shows that I work on. We go there and we have a barbecue after the show backstage. We're pretty much normal people, except that we do take off our costumes. We don't hang out backstage with costumes on. That's a myth. But, you know, we do rub shoulders with everybody. We will help each other along the road and doing things. One guy knows how to weld. Another guy needs a welder. We borrow from each other. We don't run out. And there is that us and them. That is huge. And we borrow a term from the gypsies, the gajos. They're the gajos, and we are the people with the show. And pretty much doesn't mean we won't associate with the town people, but our social lives, pretty much we stay together, because our neighborhood, our community, goes from one town to the next. You know, we form relationships with town people. They're not going to be in the next town. And so we stick together. And I always got along great with the concession people, because they liked having us there, because they knew that our name would draw people in and they would be able to sell more items to the people. I don't know that the animal people would like being called second. They pretty much – they think they're the top, and they do. Those people work like crazy, a lot more than we do. They have to care for those animals 24/7. They can't take off and go to the mall and the movies and cinemas and everything else like we do. And so, you know, there is that camaraderie there. We do stick together, but there are those divisions that he talked about, and the us and them, that's huge. And it's even, for some people, it's hard to accept somebody who comes out of the town and wants to be a part of us. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to even accept a person like that.
Linda, nothing that's being said here would be surprising to you. This is something that scholars have actually studied. You write about the anthropologist Kenneth Little, who traveled with a contemporary European circus, and what? Found essentially the same thing, that although you're going from town to town, from community to community, you're not on vacation, right? You're not there to meet the people and see the sights. You're there with a band of people who, I think, as both Rick and Bruce have been saying, are just working incredibly hard and probably don't really feel comfortable or in place if they're trying to hang around with the good people of Columbus, Ohio, or wherever they are.
That is exactly what he found. And I think he also found what Bruce was saying, that there was a sense of safety within the community of circus people. So, you know, they were fearful. The ones that he interviewed were kind of fearful of going out into the town, kind of didn't know how to act socially.
Bruce, you do write about feeling very safe, but you also you write about how there's a dualism to this, that you say that on one hand, the people were more wholesome than I could have anticipated, the people you were working with. On the other hand, you said in the course of a nine-month season in the circus, I encountered an array of sins so extensive I had to rethink whether I had ever truly known my own country. So tell us what you mean by this.
Yeah, I just want to, speaking of the sins, before I get to that, I want to just say the one group of people that would be an exception who don't mind hanging out with the town would be the young single men. So there was definitely a culture. There are definitely groupies, and there are definitely young men who want to break away. So they're definitely, certainly the clowns, I'm thinking of the young performers when I was there, who would go out into town and do what you might imagine young strapping men would be doing in a town. Yes, I would say, I want to emphasize both of those things, because you're right. On the one hand, an incredible array of sins. I call them the seven circus sins: murder, rape, bigamy, bestiality, group sex, organized crime. In the year that I was there, I encountered all of those. And you find it in America, you find it in the circus. Two people died in the course of the year that I was on the circus. One person drowned. Another person, a townie, came and went where he shouldn't and was crushed by an elephant. So there are still those encounters that are quite dangerous. The most remarkable that I experienced was a drunk man coming on, and Mr. Walenda talked about the incredible dedication of the animal people. Well, there was a Bulgarian bear handler, and somebody got into the cage, wanted to feed the bears, and therefore broke every imaginable rule, took a hot dog, slid the hot dog in, the bear grabbed for the hot dog, the man had a metal bracelet, and it ended up gashing into the man's hand. That would be dramatic enough, but it turns out, from the department of, you can't make this up, it turned out that the man was HIV positive, and they had to get the bear tested for AIDS. So you find all manner of things, but at the end, also this incredible wholesomeness. We had, you know, you name it. We had birthday parties. We had barbecues. There were two Tupperware parties in the course of the year that I was on the circus, and not one but two, in fact, dueling Bible study groups, different denominations recruiting people to come to Bible studies. So there were Pentecostals, and, you know, and there were more mainstream Christians and Protestants. So, again, there is incredible normalcy, but there's also a lot of occasion, and it attracts people from the town who are looking for adventure, and that often creates conflict.
So, Rick, we have to wind up this segment, but it sounds like, I mean, I think about it this way sometimes when I'm watching the circus. It's kind of like the UN, too. There's just, like, everybody's performing there. That on the one hand, you guys are so similar. You have such common experiences and so much commonality. Maybe it's kind of hard to identify with and associate with people who are from outside the circus. On the other hand, everybody's really incredibly different. I mean, you know, there are just so many different countries represented, so many different this talk about a diverse workplace. I assume this is the ultimate diverse workplace.
Yeah, it's multinational and multicultural. I speak three languages. I've performed on three different continents, but I married a town girl. I married a girl from outside the circus. I committed the cardinal sin there, you know, and she turned out to be an incredible performer too. But the international community, I think it made me more cosmopolitan than the average person. I don't want to sound snooty or anything like that, but you know, I think I can understand the global community better as a result of growing up in the circus.
That makes sense. All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. We're going to come back because there are challenges to this model. There are fewer circuses, as Linda was alluding to, these days than there ever were before. We're going to talk about the future of the circus and some of the challenges that it faces.
Circus, when they come to town.
Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and his dancing poodles, and me, the great Wolfiana. Greg Hill appeared in the intro. The part of Bill Curry was played by Siegfried and Roy. Never miss an episode. They're all at WNPR.org/Colin, or subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. On tomorrow's show, Julia Pestel meets the amazing Kreskin. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, it's kind of like we're staying with this theme. I've got to get a whole bunch of things ready tomorrow, so Julia Pestel from CT Improv is going to come here and take over and talk to the amazing Kreskin. And I don't know who all else. I haven't really been involved in the creation of that show, but I'm sure it'll be great. Sounds really good. With us right now, Linda Simon, professor emeritus at Skidmore College and the author of The Greatest Show on Earth, A History of the Circus. Bruce Feiler, columnist for the Sunday New York Times and author of Under the Big Top, A Season with the Circus. And since we are going to talk about now sort of the future of the circus, we'll also have with us Stephen Payne, vice president of Feld Entertainment, the parent company of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus. Before we get to Stephen Payne, I want to ask both of you this question, though. I mean, Linda, you kind of alluded to this in one of your comments. There aren't as many circus companies now as there used to be. Given your sort of God's eye view of the entire circus landscape, what does this look like to you in terms of a culture that either persists or doesn't?
Well, it looks like Cirque du Soleil. Yeah. maybe your other guests can comment about them, but you know, they're a different permutation of what a circus is. There are a lot of small circuses all over the world that are doing really inventive, wonderful things. And I think that, you know, in the kind of who is the heir to the European one-ring circuses, I think it's these small ones. And then there's Ringling, you know, Barnum and Bailey, and that's still going strong. So I don't know what the business end looks like. I think that people are still enchanted by it. A lot of the little circuses have political and social and cultural things to say and great, great amount of talent. And there are also a zillion circus schools training new talent.
Bruce, how about you? As you did this, do you feel like you were visiting a lost civilization?
Or briefly to say that you asked about how it was versus how it is.
Yeah.
It used to be that first of all, the big American, I would say, impact on the circus was to turn it from art to spectacle. So it used to be in Europe, in many ways still is in Europe, an art form. I wrote a piece in Gourmet years ago about the Monaco Circus Festival, and it became spectacle, and that really in some ways was first what Barnum did, what then the Ringlings did, and then what Irving Feld, the father, did by taking it into sort of arenas and civic centers across the country. So it became spectacle, and what it used to be was something that was new. It brought you the latest things. It was sort of like a living National Geographic. Now, once television came, the role changed. It became the one thing that you do that's real in a world that's very artificial. And I think if the circus is going to survive, it's going to have to be that. It's going to have to be real. I marched in the Winchester, Virginia Apple Blossom Festival behind the pooper scooper, behind the elephants, and there's no doubt that was the biggest hit of the parade, the guy who was working very hard to clean up the road. So there's something about real that in the age of social media that will matter more. The last thing I'll say before you move on is that the essence of the circus, when it sort of became what we imagine it today in the late 18th century, as you mentioned, was the combination of the acrobatics and the animals. And as we know, the animals are very challenged. The culture, the atmosphere, the law, the trends, Ringling just getting rid of the elephants this year, that's going to go away. And I think that the big thing that Cirque du Soleil is doing is basically coming up with a model. You know, I have mixed feelings about it, but it's coming up with a model of an animal-free circus.
All right, we're going to go to Stephen Payne about that. So, Ringling Brothers, what, they're phasing out elephants by 2018. First of all, is Bruce right? Is this going to change the circus, the inability to fuse the people with the animals?
Well, actually, first of all, Colin, thanks for having me on. Sure. The elephants transitioned off Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey back in May 1st of this year.
This year, okay.
So the last shows with elephants were in Providence, Rhode Island, and in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. We do still have a wide variety of amazing animals to go along with our human performers. The circus that's coming to Bridgeport next month features horses, tigers, camels, dogs. So there's still a wide variety of animals. But your other guest was right. There has been a challenge, if you will, for us to be able to continue to bring Ringling Brothers with animals to certain markets. We have done all we could to educate people on what we actually do for our animals, particularly for our elephants, rather than what some other activist groups would claim. But, you know, our animal care and our ability to continue to showcase the amazing bond between our human and animal performers is something we intend to continue for years to come.
Although there's just some places, I mean, there are towns in cities in America and in, I think, entire countries in Europe where you can't bring a circus that has certain species with it, right?
There are some. Sadly, a lot of those places have seen the unintended consequences of passing regulations like that. Mexico, for example, banned circuses with certain animals, but then the people who were in that circus with those animals, how are they going to care for them? How are they going to survive? We're very proud of what we do and very transparent about it. We actually teach animal welfare inspectors in a lot of cities what to look for when other circuses or exhibitors with animals come to town. That shows, you know, how proud we are of what we do every day.
How's the circus doing? I mean, you know, we're talking about the fact that in some ways the circus of 50 years ago, it faces so many challenges, not just the cultural challenges about how we feel about animals now, but just all kinds of other competing forms of entertainment. How's Ringling Brothers doing?
Well, quite well. We have two touring units of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey right now. And we really are seeing excited audiences because there's something really special about coming to the circus with your family. Regardless of, the ages from 9 to 90, I often say that the car ride home won't be boring because everyone who's come to see the show will take away something different. But it's so special that they've been able to experience it together. There really is no replacement for live family entertainment.
How do you feel? I mean, Cirque du Soleil probably is your big competition, and it's a different model, right? It's a different kind of performer, and there are no animals.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that Cirque is our competitor. A lot of our shows and a lot of their shows have a number of common elements. Some of our performers have been with Cirque. Some of Cirque performers have been with us. I mean, it is a very, very competitive environment. One of your other guests mentioned, with television. Things that you can see on television that...
Whoops, sorry. Didn't mean to cut him off. Keep going. Sorry, you got cut off for a second. Go ahead.
Oh, did you lose me?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Hopefully it wasn't on my end.
No, it was my end. Things you can see on television. Go ahead. Just finish that thought.
Things you can see on television and everything. So really what to amaze audiences today is much more challenging than it was many years ago, especially with the advent now of social media and other forms of communication.
All right. We are going to have to stop right there. Obviously, there's a lot more to say about this topic. You can email us. I know there's a lot of people who want to talk about more about the role of animals in the circus. I feel like that's an entire show. We did just want to check in with Ringling and find out a little bit about what they're doing vis-a-vis that right now. Thanks so much to everybody who helped out today. You're all just terrific guests. Linda Simon and Bruce Feiler and, of course, Rick Walenda. It's so real when you have a Walenda on the show. Thanks to Josh Nalea. He's our flying Walenda here. He's the producer of the show. And thanks to Wolfie for running the board.
Being a circus lion sucks.
Ugh. I wish there was a way to get back at the tamer. He wants us to just sit there and put his head in our mouths. That's disgusting. That's demeaning.
Oh, I've already figured out how to get back at him.
How? Oh, no. Are you going to attack him? That is not right. Violence is never the answer.
No, I had garlic and onions for lunch. With extra garlic. And extra onions.